What I thought of discussing with you is the aspect of she'ilot hilchatiyot, halachic questions that came up during the Holocaust. And it's very interesting. Chazal tell us that a person is recognized in how he acts b'kiso, b'ka'aso, u'b'koso. If you are going out with a boy and you want to see who is he really inside, not just how he is a good actor, but see how he acts b'kiso when he loses his wallet, his money, or somebody dents his car, or see how he acts b'ka'aso when he is angry, or b'koso, see how he acts when he is drunk. In extreme situations, that is when you can see who a person really is. And the Holocaust was without a doubt a super extreme situation. I don't know if any of you have heard of Viktor Frankl, Professor Viktor Frankl, and logotherapy. He's a father of, he just passed away recently, of a new school of psychology that says that meaning is the most important thing in life. And it's interesting, he wrote his doctorate before the Holocaust, and then he was an inmate in a death camp, I believe in Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, where he saw people on extreme situations, living in extreme hunger, extreme anger, extreme despair, extreme hope, he proved, and he said that is the best place to prove something, to see who a person is inside. And what I want to discuss with you is different issues that came up in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, where it helps us understand who is Am Yisrael, who are we deep inside, under the most extreme circumstances. In mitzvot ben adam lechaviro, between man and his fellow man, obviously, when a person is dying of hunger, we cannot judge him if he grabs an extra piece of bread. That is not considered stealing, because he has to save himself. But a personal story of my wife and her family. This was families who ran away from Europe, from Germany, before the war, in about 1938, 39. And a family comes to New York, and where my wife's grandmother lived, and my mother-in-law, where she grew up in the Bronx. And she went shopping in the makolet, in the grocery store. And in comes a Jewish woman who speaks Yiddish. And she explains to anyone who is willing to listen that she and her family just escaped from Hitler's Germany. They made it to America, but they do not have where to sleep. They don't have money. They don't have food. And my wife's grandmother invited this family to live with them. They lived with them for a half a year, for 6 months, in the small apartment, to bring in another family in America. That is a type of chesed that really shows what Am Yisrael is like. This is not a fable. It's not a legend. This I heard from my mother-in-law, who lived there. And until this day, the Hauser family is connected with the Zenger family because they lived together for those 6 months. Total strangers, but just because they were Jewish, they needed a place, they were invited, and they lived with them for 6 months. Another example of a story, Ben Adam Lechaviro. Maybe some of you have heard of the Bendheim family. I believe that they are one of the donors to the Midrasha where you are studying, a very wealthy family. And the father, his name was Charles Bentheim. His son, who I know, his name is Jackie Bentheim. And after the outbreak of the World War II, 1939, there was a short period, where the Germans, they already did not allow Jews to send money out of Germany, but if a Jew in Germany owed money to a company abroad, the Germans allowed them to pay their debt. You understand? Can somebody want to translate to Spanish? Comprendo? And there was a wealthy Jew in Germany who wanted to run away from Germany, and he wanted to send his money out so that he would have money when he comes to America. And he looked in, he had a phone book from New York, and he looked for Jewish names of Jewish businesses from the last name. And what he did is he divided his money into three groups, into three parts, and he sent a letter saying, this is the money that I owe you for my last order. I thank you very much for your services. And he sent a lot of money to three different Jewish businessmen. And one of them was this, Charles Bentheim. Charles Bentheim, out of nowhere, gets a huge amount of money from Germany with a letter that this Jew from Germany owes him all of this money. And he thinks that something is suspicious. And what he did is he opened a new bank account. He deposited the money in a bank account. And he just left it there because there was something weird. Maybe it was a mistake. Anyway, after the war, 6 years later, he gets a phone call from this Jew from Germany saying that I hope you remember that 6 years ago I sent a huge amount of money and I really just used that as an excuse to get the money out of Germany. And now, I would like for you to return the money. And Mr. Bentheim gave him the money. And the other two Jewish businessmen, either they forgot, they didn't know where the money was, they didn't understand that it was just a trick to get the money out of Germany. But here was an honest, friendly Jewish businessman, and I know this story from the Bentheim family, that he sent his oldest son, Mr. Bentheim sent his oldest son, and took all of the money out of the bank account and returned it to this Jew. This shows the Avat Yisrael, the love of fellow Jew. But that is something that we see all the time in the Israeli army, where people help each other, people risk their lives to save each other. But what I want to do is to discuss with you different questions from the halachic responsa. You all know what is responsa? She'ilot u'tshuvot. Now what is beautiful here is that these are documented questions and answers. They are all from a sefer by Rav Ephraim Oshri, called She'ilot u'tshuvot mima'amakim. And he wrote down the questions and the answers, and he hid them in milk canisters and buried them. And after the war, he returned to Kovno and uncovered. And afterwards, he published all of these books. I believe there are 5 volumes. And what's interesting is not so much the questions, although, as we'll see, that is also very interesting. I'm sorry, the answers are usually very easy, because almost everything is pikuach nefesh. And you all know that as soon as someone's life isn't in danger, saving lives supersedes Shabbat. You eat on Yom Kippur. You do anything that you can to save life. And if so, what is really interesting is not so much the answer, but the question. By the way, many of you are probably thinking, what should I study in university? I will give you a tip. One of the easiest ways to get a thesis or a doctorate is to go back to the historic halachic questions from that time period, which we find in the Sifrut, in the Sfarim. And that is the best way to learn about the time period, because it was written Bishat Emet. It was written in real time, and these are real questions with real people. Now, you have to be a little careful, because Professor Chaim Soloveitchik said that to learn about day-to-day life from questions to rabbis is like to try and learn about day-to-day life from a local police ledger, from the calendar in a police department. You understand? The police, they only deal with extreme situations. They do not deal with normal situations. On the other hand, it is true regarding halakhic questions that we can see, we can get a picture from another piece of the puzzle and another piece of the puzzle until we can group together what was life really like in the ghetto. And although you have heard stories of Holocaust survivors, you have seen movies about Holocaust survivors, what we will do now in the next half hour is to see what was day-to-day life like in the Kovno ghetto through the questions which were asked. And it's unbelievable how many Jews were preoccupied with the Torah, with the mitzvot, even under such difficult situations. For example, one of the laws that the Germans, Yimach Shemam, laid in the ghetto was that women were not allowed to get pregnant. And you have to understand that in these difficult times, obviously nobody wanted to get pregnant, but sometimes it happened. And especially in those days, there was not sophisticated birth control. And a woman who was pregnant came to ask the rabbi, Rabbi Oshri, about aborting, killing the fetus. Now, like I said, everybody knows the obvious answer is that a fetus is not considered on a high level of life like a human being after he is born. After a baby is born, he and the mother are equal. You do not kill the mother to save the baby, and you do not kill the baby to save the mother after he is born. But as long as the child is in the mother's womb, he is not considered a regular person, and the halacha is simple. The mother saves her life by killing, by aborting the fetus in her stomach. Again, it is not a difficult answer, but the question shows us what life was like in the ghetto. Another example is an interesting question about mezuzah. Very often, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, I will not say Yimach Shemam every time because that will take up much of the 40 minutes that we have, but I will say one big Yimach Shemam. May their memory be obliterated. The Germans very often closed the ghetto more and more and more as more and more Jews were killed. And at first, in many ghettos, there was one family per apartment. And then they moved in a second family, and then a third family. And things were getting very, very stuffy. And what happened with the old apartments? The Germans took them for themselves. Now, the question was asked, do we need to put up a mezuzah on the door of the apartment? You all know that every Jewish home needs a mezuzah on every room. But there is an interesting halakha that if your house is just temporary, in Chutz La'aretz, a temporary house is you can live there for 30 days, and it is exempt from mezuzah. In Eretz Yisrael, where this is our hometown, even one night, the house is already obligated to have a mezuzah. But in Chutz La'aretz, up to 30 days, it does not need a mezuzah. Now the problem was, when the Jews were moved from one part of the ghetto to the next, things got lost. Sometimes they forgot the mezuzah, and they asked Rav Oshri, the rabbi of Kovno, are we obligated to put up a mezuzah every time we move? Rav Oshri said that the apartments in the ghetto have the halakha like a jail. How do you say jail in Spanish? Comprendo? A jail. And when a person is thrown in jail against their will, he does not need a mezuzah, because that is not considered a living quarters. That is hell. He does not want to live there at all. Similarly, said Rav Ashri, everybody knew that their house in the ghetto was temporary. And even if you stayed there for more than 30 days, you could be there 2-3 months, but you knew that any minute the Germans will move you away. So it was always temporary. And Rav Ashri gives an example. He says that the way that people would part with each other in the ghetto, they would not say adios. They would say, lehitraot ba'olam haba. I'll see you in the world to come. In other words, death was part of everyday life. And that is the way that people spoke to each other. Another term that he mentions in that responsa, he says that we are all like dead people on vacation. That it's just a matter of time before we return to hell. And all of this influences his decision that the houses are exempt from mezuzah. Another very interesting question that got me thinking and understanding what was life in the ghetto, I have to tell you, my father-in-law was in the ghetto, and I had heard many stories about the ghetto, but I never really thought of day-to-day life until I saw the following question. The question was asked by Kohanim before Yom Tov. You all know that in Chutz La'aretz, Birkat Kohanim, the Kohanim, only say the priestly blessing on Yom Tov. And what was the problem? The problem was that their shoes were falling apart. And when a Kohen does Birkat Kohanim, he must take off his shoes. And the problem was, and this is what they asked the rabbi, if we take off our shoes, they will fall apart. Because what keeps them tied onto our feet, that's what keeps the shoe together. And if we take them off, we will not have shoes anymore. And then he discusses part of the question that there is no soap in the ghetto. There is a shortage of water. Everyone is covered with boils, with sores. They are itching. All the time they are itching. And this idea of Birkat Kohanim, of taking off their shoes, their feet have been covered for months, and there will be such a terrible smell and terrible pain and itching, and the shoes will fall apart. So obviously, Rav Oshri said that they can do Birkat Kohanim without taking off their shoes. But what is interesting is I never thought of what is life like without showers, without soap, always itching, covered with sores. I always thought about the problem in the ghetto of that people were hungry, which is true, and you see it in the pictures. But from this story, I understood, A, what a pain it was to always be itching, what a pain it was to not be able to take off your shoes, what smell there was that people just stink, but also how much the Jewish people wanted to observe the mitzvah of Birkat Kohanim. They tell Rav Oshri, we cannot do without Birkat Kohanim. And this shows the integrity. How do you say integrity? Okay, the integrity of the Jewish people. Another interesting question was, again, the answer is not hard. What is difficult is to read the question. Rav Oshri goes into the details that he was giving a shiur in Gemara, and at 10 o'clock at night, after all of the men come home from a long day in hard work, many men would come to learn a shiur in Gemara. And even though half of them are falling asleep all the time because they are so tired from the hard labor, they come to learn. And in the middle of a shiur, one of the participants, his name is Rav Zalman Sher, in the middle of the class at 10 o'clock at night, his daughter-in-law comes into the class, weeping, wailing, crying, and they cannot understand her, but she is telling her father-in-law, this Zalman, that her husband, his son, was just murdered, together with their three sons. All of them were just murdered a minute ago. She is coming in. She tells her father-in-law that he just lost his son and his three grandchildren. And the father-in-law gets a heart attack. And he also dies. And the question was, what to do regarding the tahara? You all know that before a person is buried, his body must be washed, and he must be given a proper funeral. And here there's a shortage of water. And also they don't know, nobody knows ever what's going to be tomorrow. And they asked Rav Oshri, maybe we should stop the shiur and do the tahara, wash the dead man Zalman to wash his body right then and there. And that's what they did. They closed the gemarot. They put him on the table where they were studying. They washed his body from head to toe, prepared him for burial. And this gives us an insight on what day-to-day life was like. Now, this daughter-in-law, not only did she just lose her husband and her children, she now lost her father-in-law. All of this, one after the other, on the same day. And it is very unbelievable to think that still under these conditions, Jews sit and they learn Gemara, and the following day they learn Gemara, and it just goes to show what Am Yisrael, how dedicated we are. Another example of an interesting story that we see in the Responsa, where the Germans, Yimach Shemam, they, in the ghetto, there also were dead horses and dead dogs. And what the Germans did is they would take the Sifrei Torah, tear them, and use them to cover up the dead animals until they could be taken away. Now the halacha is, when a person sees a Sefer Torah ripped, or even if you hear that a Sefer Torah was ripped, you have to do kriya. You have to tear your shirt, Just like if Chas V'Shalom, a parent dies, when a Sefer Torah is ripped, it is similar. Not only that, you have to fast on that day. What is the problem? The people of Kovno all see this ripped Sefer Torah. They see it defiled with the blood of the dogs and of the horses. But if they fast, they might die of hunger. And Rav Ashri says, obviously, you are not allowed to fast. You do not have to tear your clothing because it is freezing cold in Poland and the Jews did not have a lot of clothing. So they did not have to tear, they did not have to fast. He said, what you should do is if you can, give tzedakah, give charity as much as you can to another poor person in place of the fast. So again, this question and answer cannot help us in day-to-day life today in the land of Israel. But it helps us understand what life was like in the ghetto. Another type of story, I will just give you examples of different types of story. Sometimes what is interesting is not the question, not even the answer, but what happens at the end of the story. And in the question that Rav Ephraim Oshri was asked, we mentioned that women were not allowed to get pregnant in the ghetto. If a woman was seen pregnant, she was killed on the spot. A woman got pregnant. A German officer saw her pregnant and killed her on the spot. But it happened to be right outside of the Jewish hospital. And they asked Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, do they have an obligation to try and save the baby inside the mother? Because even the adults, even strong people, are dying left and right. The child will probably not live. Not only that, you're not allowed to defile, to cut open a dead person. The mother is dead. So why should we try and save the baby? Now the answer is not that difficult, because every Jewish life, even for a moment, is holy. And he said, immediately bring the woman up, do an operation, save the baby. And in fact, the baby was saved. But unfortunately, the end of the response tells the end of the story. That the Germans, Yimach Shemam, they were so orderly that the person who shot, the German who shot the woman, forgot to write down her Tu'dat Zehut, her identity number. So he went back to the hospital to write down her identity number, and he hears this baby crying. He understood that this is the baby who was taken out of the mother. He takes the baby, throws the baby against the wall, and kills the baby as well. This is all there in black and white to understand what we went through. Sometimes the question only rose years after the Holocaust. Years after the Holocaust, Rav Ephraim Oshri was dealt with the following question. During the ghetto, part of the problem was people heard different rumors. How do you say rumor? It might not be true. But if your life depends on it, you act upon it. There was a rumor that the Germans were going to take away and kill all of the single women. Anybody who was not married. And there was a woman whose husband was taken away to a labor camp, never returned. And she did not want to be killed. So what she did was she had a fictitious marriage. She married a Jew in order to save herself. They lived in the same apartment. Eventually, they fell in love. And after the war, they found each other, and they married, and she had a child. And years later, in the late 1960s, this child became a rabbi of a community, I believe, in England. And here's the rabbi in his shul, and one day, an older man comes in and asks to see the rabbi. And he says, "I'm the rabbi." This older man comes up to him and starts choking him and cursing him and cursing his mother. It turns out that the first husband did not die. He was sent to a labor camp. He survived. It took him many years until he tracked down his wife. She had already passed away, but in the meantime, she had married a second man. And as this rabbi is being strangled, he understands that he is what? He is a mamzer. And he understands he must divorce his wife. And his children are mamzerim. And his whole life is about to be destroyed. And this is many years after the Holocaust. What did he ask Rav Oshri? He said, can a mamzer be a rabbi? And Rav Oshri answers him that even though technically, yes, the rabbi can be a mamzer, but he says it's not a good idea, because every time you want to give musar, you want to tell people that they should act on a higher, more spiritual level, people will tell him, "What are you telling us? You're just a mamzer. You're a bastard." And this whole story, a true documented story, happened years after the Holocaust. Another issue that came up after the Holocaust was there were women, young women, were taken, and they had tattooed on their arms, "Prostitutes for Hitler's army." They were taken on a bus as a reward to the German soldiers if they won a battle. They would bring them a busload of Jewish girls, and they would use them. And that was the prize for the German soldiers. Now, what is the question? Most of you probably know that a married woman who sleeps with another man willingly is not allowed to return to her husband. And the question is, these women, they did not kick and fight and scream every time they were taken to the German soldiers. They did not go willingly. Are they allowed to return to their husbands after the war? And Rav Oshri paskined that yes, even though they did not kick and scream the whole time, they obviously were not doing so willingly. That is not considered prostitution. It is not considered having an affair with another man. But again, the main point that we see from these stories is what Am Yisrael went through. Now, when I look at this book, and I just gave you an example of 10, 12, 13 questions that were asked in real time during the Holocaust, I cannot help but think, what a great nation Am Yisrael is. Ashrecha Yisrael. How can God not redeem us? You know, sometimes people ask, how can Zionism be part of the redemption? The state of Israel is not religious. Most of the Jews are not religious. I look at the Jews in the Holocaust, and I look at my Father in heaven, and I say, my children don't listen to me like we listen to you. How can Hashem not redeem his children? How can Hashem not love Am Yisrael after what we went through? And what bothers the Jew in the ghetto? Can I do Birkat Kohanim or not? Can I return to my husband or not? Saving a child or not? Putting a mezuzah or not? This is mind-boggling. And I know for me, this is one of the strongest lessons of the Shoah. To be melamed zchut, to give the benefit of the doubt to all of the people of Israel who inside, like we see, when do you say, see who a person is? Inside? See how he acts under extreme situations. Another point that he mentions, which is a good example, he says there was no cannibalism in the ghetto. Jews did not eat other Jews. Even after they died, there's a famous South American football team that their plane crashed in the Andes and they started eating each other because they were dying of starvation. You've heard of that? The Jewish people in the ghetto, they did not eat each other. That was a question that was not asked. And here we see the greatness again of the Jewish people. The Jewish people, we must love the Jewish people, just like Hashem obviously loves the Jewish people. Another aspect of Yom HaShoah. Shalom.